wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
So, how are we doing today?
Casper, I'm very well. The weather could be a bit warmer, though.
It
would be nice, but at least we're not getting pelted down on like those poor people down on the West Coast.
Quite a cool morning.
Poor things. So, but anyway, music. Music, my second favourite subject after chemistry, or possibly my equal favourite, maybe. So, there is a study out now saying something that we'd probably suspected, long suspected, I guess, but never sort of proven, is that music can help in the treatment of long-term chronic pain. And the fact is that this particular music, it can't just be any old music. It's got to be music that you like, or indeed music that you think that you've had a hand in actually selecting or choosing, which is kind of interesting. So, a bunch of folk in London, Queen Mary University of London, have been looking at this question from the psych department there. And what they did was they got 286 adults, and all of these, unfortunately, were afflicted by long-term pain, and apparently that sort of qualifies as 12 months or longer, which sucks. And they were asked to rate their pain basically before and after listening to particular pieces of music. And I guess the long and the short of it is that if they were listening to music that they don't like, then they didn't report any relief of pain. However, if they were listening to music that they did like, or that they thought that they had a choice in actually selecting, then they definitely reported decrease in pain, so relief of pain. And this is interesting stuff. So from what I can make out about the paper, what they got a composer to do was to sort of compose specially written pieces of music for this trial. And what they found is that the tempo of the music or the complexity of the music or whatever didn't really have anything to do with how the pain was mediated. Okay, so it wasn't to do with the actual sort of details of the music, it was the actual music itself. Okay, and so what the composer did was that they wrote two sort of versions of the same piece of music. One was sort of very simple and one was very complex, but overall the music had the same sort of, I guess, overall arch, I suppose. And what they found was that basically the participants liked both pieces of music equally. However, when the participants were allowed to sort of choose between the two, or given at least the impression that they were allowed to choose between the two, then they reported that that instance alone, that fact that they could have some sort of input into the whole situation, actually led to them sort of reporting pain relief. And you know, that's quite weird, isn't it?
Yeah. But do you think it's because when you hear something, you're sort of expecting the kind of music that we'll be playing, you're not like taken aback or sort of surprised or irked by it being something you dislike?
Yeah, I don't know. The explanation that they came up with for this is that when we're listening to music that we like, our brain is very, very intensely involved with listening to that. You know, it's not just background music. If it's something that you're really into, then you're concentrating on that. And then because of that, then the processing power of the brain to do other things then decreases, mm-hmm. because you're giving that your all. And so therefore you can't concentrate on pain at the same time. So
it's a distractive method almost.
Essentially, yeah, by the sound of it. So, yeah.
It's interesting that the genre of the music doesn't seem to play in at all, because we often think of some genres like classical music to be like good or healthy or
or lo-fi music, you know.
Yeah, yeah, whereas you know other types
soft,
of music are
relaxing sounds,
yeah, not so relaxing,
not like but I guess you know everybody likes what they like, and again they were saying you know the tempo and everything doesn't matter, so you know it could be you know they might like that sort of stuff if they're concentrating on it and that's their thing. And again, they also found that if you were really sort of into music in your everyday life, if you really, you know, loved it, then again you would get a bigger effect that you would experience more pain relief than if music was nothing more than sort of a background thing to you. So I
you
guess,
could intensely engage with it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You have a greater appreciation for the different aspects
applied to other like hobbies or other things aside from music, if the point is to distract people by showing them something they're interested in.
Yep. And again, I'm sure that that's probably a topic of study for this group. Something like movies or something like that, something that you're really intensely into. You see your favorite movie again and again and again and again. And I'm sure that, that could have some beneficial properties as well. So, there's just so much that we don't know about us. There's so much we don't know about the brain. We think we kind of do, but we kind of don't really. And, there's still so much research to be done. Just how our mind works, how our brain operates, and it's utterly fascinating stuff. And, of course, it all comes down to chemistry, of course.
I bet it does.
But now,
it
all the time
comes back to chemistry.
Thank you, Emily. There we go. Yes.
Now a lot of the time we often dismiss this sort of chemistry, right? Like we'll think, people might like particular things, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's like good for them. Or just because you like something, it doesn't mean it's going to be like healthy for you. So it's interesting to think that the brain's chemistry can turn some external stimulus of a particular type for that particular person into an actual
beneficial
response.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And there's the amazing thing. So, I think this is fascinating stuff. As usual, as we often say here, still, the more research needs to be done,
And, but it's nice to have some good news.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I hope there's nobody out there suffering, chronic pain or anything, but if you're feeling a bit down, then go and whip on your favourite CD. Go and stream your favourite something. I forget that you people don't use, CDs anymore, because...
Cardinal sin.
Yeah. But go and stream your favourite song or something like that, and it'll give you a cheer.
Maybe the nostalgia of putting on a record would help too.
Ah, there we go. Yes.
Or tune into 95 BFM.
Yeah. For your favourite tunes.
There we go.
Tune into your favourite radio station.
Life-affirming music, yeah.
So what other science stories do we have that we can plug the station into?
Yes.
Okay, so here's something I've never thought about, and I love, that's one of the reasons I really like doing this, is that I learn stuff, and stuff that you never think about. Okay, so you are in space. You're off to, let's say, Mars or something like that, or you're on the International Space Station or whatever. You need your oxygen, don't you? You kind of do. It's
pretty
kind
crucial.
Of important. It is pretty crucial. Where does it come from? Because there ain't no oxygen out in space.
I assume you take a little bit off with us, yeah.
And see, this too is a question that I've never really sort of addressed. And so what they do, the way that they make oxygen so that people survive on the International Space Station and stuff, is a thing called electrolysis, where essentially, in its simplest form, you take water, you pass a current through water, and then at one electrode, oxygen bubbles off, at the other electrode, hydrogen bubbles off. And that's the way that you make your oxygen, okay? Which is great. That's all well and good. Now, if you do that on planet Earth, and I could take you to the chemistry lab and show you this in person if needs be, you will see literally little bubbles of oxygen coming off here, little bubbles of hydrogen coming off here, okay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what happens when you try and do that? Excuse me, I'm getting too excited here. What happens when you try and do that in space? What happens to those bubbles?
Float.
No, they don't.
Oh.
That's the thing. You are in very low gravity conditions. They call microgravity, okay? If you're in microgravity, then bubbles are not buoyant anymore. And bubbles do not float to the surface.
So they're still in the liquid.
Yes, exactly. And I never thought of
that.
Yes, indeed. So somehow you've got to get the bloody bubbles out of the liquid. If you're making this oxygen, how do you get the bubbles out of the liquid? And also the bubbles also stick to the electrodes as well. So you're trying to overcome this problem. So at the moment, the way that they get over this on the space station, apparently, is they've got a centrifuge sort of system, okay? And so a centrifuge sort of creates artificial gravity sort of thing. And so you can separate out the gas bubbles from liquid water like that. But if we're going to go to Mars, and chances are somebody's going to at some stage, the apparatus that they've got on the space station is just too big, too bulky, and too prone to not working, apparently, that, you know, we've got to come up with something different. And so there's a lot of work going in on this, as you might well expect. And what these people have come up with, these workers in the UK and the US and in Germany, is magnets. Surprisingly, okay? Magnets may well work here. And
I assume we don't have little metal filings in the oxygen.
Well, funnily enough, funny that you mentioned that. In fact, oxygen itself is magnetic. Now, there's something that you never knew, I'm sure.
That's right, I didn't.
Oxygen is attracted to magnets. Can I get a collective wow, please?
I feel like this has huge implications, but I have no idea how this works.
Oxygen is attracted to magnets.
Yes, yep, yep. So if you make some liquid oxygen, cool it down, you pour it between the poles of a magnet, it sticks. Oh. Okay, it's true, I'm not kidding. You're looking doubtful.
It's an idea that baffles me.
looks of disbelief all around the studio.
Okay, but basically, that works, okay? Now, the way that they test... Now, so how do they test this? Because they want to simulate microgravity conditions, so they don't want to have to go up into space because that's going to cost a buttload. So they've got a thing called a drop tower in Bremen in Germany.
Bremen.
Mm-hmm. And this thing is about 150-odd metres high. Now, you know when you're in a very fast elevator and it goes like that.
Whatever's in the elevator is sort of suspended.
Yeah, this is kind of that on steroids sort of thing. So you can drop very, very, very fast down there, and at some point, at whatever speed you're travelling, you are simulating microgravity. So you can imagine these experiments are going to be really, really difficult to set up because they're going to set up this electrolysis simulation. And they've got to set up these magnets, and then they've got to drop it at this ridiculously fast speed so that it gets to the point where there's no gravity in there, and then they've got to analyze it all somehow. So
it's great that there are people out there with the time to do this sort of thing.
A hell of a difficult thing to do. But yeah, basically what they've found is they've got simple neodymium magnets. Have you heard of neodymium magnets?
Absolutely not.
No? But. Okay. So they're basically sort of the strongest magnets that you can go down the shop and buy. They'll take your finger off if you sort of squidge them between them. And they basically found that, yeah, these bubbles in microgravity can essentially be directed by the magnets to start coalescing and forming big bubbles, which is what you want, and then they can easily separate those out from the liquid phase. So
does this improve the efficiency of oxygen supply in space?
It's not necessarily the efficiency, because you're going to generate the same amount regardless. It's actually the collecting of it, so getting it free from the liquid phase, and they call this magnetic phase separation. So you're separating a gas phase, the oxygen gas, from the liquid phase, the water. And absolutely fascinating stuff. And so, you know, there's obviously a lot of important work going on here, and this could be very, very important if and when we do end up going to Mars on, you know, some very, very long space journey. So
it's essentially a simplification of the method currently being used the space station.
It's a different method in terms of not having to use a centrifuge anymore.
Right.
So not so much a simplification, but basically a totally different method that's an improvement on what is now currently used. So, yeah, spare a thought for all those people on the space station when you look at the stars tonight, and just think, my goodness, one little hole in that thing, and boy, their history, you know. So they're braver than I am, put it that way. Anyway, so finally... bacteria. Let's talk about bacteria, and let's talk about sweat. Okay.
Favorite topic.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be great
if... Did I put on deodorant this morning?
Wouldn't it be great if you could power an electronic apparatus using your sweat? And now you can. There we go.
So, wow.
So thanks to some people over at University of Massachusetts in Amherst, in the States. So what they have developed is a thing called a biofilm, and that is just essentially a film of biological thingies, essentially. And, you know, if you leave a boat in the water or something like that, it gets fouled by biofilms and stuff like that. So biofilms, very, very important things. And what they've got is this biofilm that's made of a dead bacterium, which is really, really weird. But importantly, this dead bacterium that they've got, and it's a thing called Geobacter sulforeductans, okay?
I almost guessed it.
And this thing grows in big mats. And these mats are sort of linked to each other by tiny, tiny little what we would call nanowires, okay? So really, really thin little connections made essentially of atoms between them, okay? And so what you can do is you can take this biofilm that has grown, you can scrape it off, and what you can do is etch little circuits, tiny, tiny little circuits on this biofilm, whack it between a couple of electrodes, and close it up in a nice sticky polymer thing, and then you can stick that to yourself. And what this then does is it utilizes the energy that is involved in the evaporation of water. Now, when you get out of the swimming pool on a nice hot day, how do you feel?
Shivery.
Exactly, exactly, shivery. And you feel shivery because you're covered in water and the water is evaporating. And when the water evaporates, that requires heat to do that. And so it's taking heat from your body as it evaporates. Okay, and this is a substantial amount of heat. Now, what they have done basically is that they've worked this so that this device now that they're sticking to the skin is going to use that energy that is involved in your sweat, the moisture on your body, evaporating. And so they've found a way to basically take that energy and use it as a battery, essentially, as a battery that's never going to run out as long as you've got moisture on your skin.
And what sorts of things could that power? Is this a lot of energy?
Or what's the practical use of it?
I was going to say an MP3 player, but that's out of date now too, isn't it?
So, you know. So maybe just enough to charge your phone?
I don't know, to tell you the truth. I don't know. They didn't specify, I don't think, in the paper, but you know, they can certainly get an electric current out of this, which is, you know, kind of pretty amazing. And
has anything similar been discovered before, or is this quite groundbreaking?
What they found was that this actual bacterium, when it's alive, it can actually generate electricity.
Mm.
Okay. But the trouble is that you have to feed it and water it. You have to keep it alive. So that's kind of...
my pet bacteria.
Exactly, pet bacteria, yes. And so you've got to do that. And so obviously it's beneficial to have a dead bacterium because therefore you don't...
yeah, if only we can just wear its corpses.
Exactly, yes. I wonder if they got ethics approval for this one. I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Questionable.
But yeah, so there you go. That's this week in science, I guess.
Oh, fantastic.
And thank you to MoTat as per usual. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I drove past there this morning, so if you've got a spare weekend day or something like that, pop out to MoTat. It's always wonderful out there.
And thank you so much, Alan, for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Alan.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MoTat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.